I have two questions. One question is this. In listening to your talks and also reading the Views On series, I'm trying to get a better understanding of where do social relations exist in relationship to the base and the superstructure. My understanding is that the social relations, like the oppression of women, for example, are rooted fundamentally in the economic base of society, but then they take expression within the superstructure of society. Could you speak to that more? The other question is related in some ways. How do you see the application of solid core and elasticity within the transformation of the production relations and in the economic base of society under socialism?
Why was it again we decided to have this question? That's just a joking way of saying those are good and big questions. The idea of the base and superstructure basically comes from Marx, originally, and talking about how, when he talks about how their people enter into definite definite production relations in the carrying out of production, and that on that arises on that substructure, as he calls it, or base, arises a superstructure of politics and ideology, basically. But then there is there's this other statement about the four alls, in which he characterizes it. You have class relations, that they rest on certain production relations, that there are certain social relations corresponding to that, and there are ideas that correspond, as he puts it, to those social relations. So, I mean, the point of these things is not to get, formulistic about it, but I think the essential thing here is that the economic relations of society are the most fundamental relations. The most fundamental fact is that people enter into, these certain definite production relations in order to carry out the production and reproduction of the material requirements of life, and more or less according to, without being mechanical about it, more or less according to what the character of the productive forces is, you will get a more or less, you'll get production relations that more or less correspond to and are, as Marx once put it, the appropriate or the more appropriate means for developing the productive forces. And so what do we mean by the productive forces? Well, technology, the raw materials that are worked on in production, and the people, as well as the land, the raw materials, the technology that's developed, and the people with their ability to think and with their thoughts and knowledge and skills and so on. So those are the basic productive forces, and you, more or less according to the character of them at a given time, and if you go back into early society when people were mainly doing hunting and gathering, you don't have a state. Because of the way of life that they have, more or less, corresponds with certain production relations that are people doing things cooperatively. We've described it in various ways as more or less as early communal forms of society, which don't have antagonistic social groups, antagonistic classes in the way that people are, it doesn't give rise to that, in the way that people come together to gather and hunt and so on. But that, as the way in which people develop new means of doing that, sometimes the technology or the other productive forces, such as what they settle on land, it isn't, sometimes there's been in the history of Marxism, and especially I think under the influence of Stalin, a little bit of this notion of, things going from a lower to a higher level, from a more difficult to a less difficult way of life. And that's not really a thoroughly dialectical materialist way to understand it. And it actually introduces a certain religious notion almost into it, a notion of a certain directionality. And if you have a directionality, then you have to have a director, so you somewhere lurking in the back of that, and it goes along with certain, can go along with certain like teleological ideas, as it's called, like the idea this is all working, all of this is all working towards some end. And you can sort of get, you know, see communism then as almost a religious view, a different religious view. Well, it can almost be, become the equivalent of God works in mysterious ways, except instead of saying God, you say history. You know, this is all works out in the end, because in the end we get to communism. That was one of the big things that Bill Martin and I were battling around and grappling with from different angles through a good part of the book, the Conversations book. So it's not, what I'm trying to get at here without going too far afield, is that it's not that there's some evolution from a more difficult to an easier way of life. You know, hunting and gathering in some circumstances is not necessarily more difficult, and the question almost becomes impossible to answer. You know, is it more difficult to do that, or is it more difficult to farm? Well, for whom and when and all that sort of thing. But if you like, take the example I've given in other places of ancient Mexico. People did a lot of hunting and gathering, and then there were some climatic changes, and some of the things they were relying on in their gathering and hunting, they used up over generations. And of course that, and together with climatic changes, they had to go, you know, they didn't have a meeting of the lineage groups of the tribe or whatever and say, let's go settle down and farm. But they sort of went in search of a way to be able to live, and they ended up settling and farming near a river, and that changed their productive forces. They settled down, they had land in a different way than before. They had a river there, which became part of the productive forces. It had a differential influence, to oversimplify this a bit, but to get at some of the essentials of it, had a differential influence. People who were closer to the river, the land was more fertile, were more favored, etc., etc. So a change in productive forces led to a change in their social organization, and in particular, the particular definite production relations they entered into, not because it was necessarily a quote-unquote better way of life, but because necessity, once again, caused them to make changes. And this is a point we should understand that, you know, and really, you know, grasp deeply, that a lot of times people make changes, and this is the point about necessity and freedom, and also the point about the ruling class that we're living under. They make changes that have results that are unanticipated by them, and even in a certain sense, unanticipatable. You know, you may be able to identify certain trends, but not where it's all going to go. And so this is, you know, people leave a certain way of life because of necessity. You know, it may not be just necessity coming from nature. It might be that other groups are making war on them and they can't live there anymore, for example. You know, there could be a lot of different ways that necessity impinges and imposes on them a need for change. So anyway, if they change the character of their productive forces for whatever reason, could be through new innovations within the same grouping in the same geographic area, but they make innovations, they change their productive forces, and at a certain point, under certain circumstances, that'll call forth a change in the production relations. And if there develops an antagonism, a really deep conflict between the new productive forces and the old production relations, then you'll have to have some sort of radical change in the social organization. And that's when that gets acutely reflected. It's not that nobody argues about whether this is the best way of life or not, but in the meantime, but if that gets acutely expressed, then it'll get expressed in an acute way in the thinking of and the actions of people trying to hold on to the old way or trying to bring into being a new way. So the essential and fundamental thing is the production relations, and that's what constitutes the essence and core of the underlying material certainly underlying economic base. But bound up with these, just as once you reach a certain, all production relations are not expressive of class relations. As I gave an example, early communal society had production relations, but not class relations and not specifically class antagonisms. But there are always certain social relations that are bound up with the overall way of life, if you will, the overall way in which people are going about meeting the requirements of life. For example, in early communal society, if you think back to a society without formula, You know, and without any of the other modern technology that we have, well, then the burden of not only having, I mean, we may get to the point where human beings will reproduce without the instrumentality of a human being involved technologically, and that'll obviously bring about big social changes, you know, and there'll be ideological battle about whether that's good or bad, even under communism, you know, if it doesn't happen first. But if you go back to an early communal society where they don't have technology, the point of no formula is that the women not only become pregnant and bear the children, but they also have to be responsible for nourishing them, literally by nursing them. Nobody can substitute for that role if you don't have an acceptable substitute. The children will all die. So that imposes, even in that society, a certain social relation, a certain division of labor, which means that, for example, women, while they may engage in labor and generally do, you know, there's also no birth control. You know, there may be, you know, under certain circumstances, very, you know, compared to our society, undeveloped means of abortion, but that's going to be, at best, hit and miss and often disastrous. So it's probably not going to be attempted that much. So you're going to have women quite often pregnant. That's going to be, you know, during those child-bearing years, which is a good part of a human being, a woman's life, then they're going to be in this cycle of having children, some of which are going to die. And sometimes the women are going to die because, you know, the problems in childbirth. They don't have, you know, the medical facilities to have a cesarean or whatever, you know. But even leaving aside that, you're going to have a division of labor where women are going to be in this cycle of getting pregnant periodically, most of them, except for those who for one reason or another are biologically unable to, or particular women who might be for a particular odd reason socially outcast or whatever. But talking about the general phenomenon, you're going to have women getting repeatedly and periodically pregnant and then having to nurse children. So whether, you know, maybe that'll be more collectivized among the women, but it's going to be mainly the women who are going to have to take on the main share of that. Now, that has certain implications in terms of social organization and even in terms of economic organization. It reacts back on it because it means the kind of economic work that women are going to do in that condition is going to be influenced and in certain ways limited by this whole child-bearing and child-rearing phenomenon. So they're going to do more of the gathering and more activities that are more, you know, centered around wherever the home, temporary or longer term, of the group of people is, whereas you have more freedom, for example, for the men to go off for longer periods of time on hunts or whatever. But that doesn't carry any, in general, any social advantage or stigma in that early form of society. It's just a sort of a natural, quote-unquote, division of labor. But it's a social relation. It is a social relation. And while not literally, you know, it's in and of itself an economic relation, it's closely interconnected with the economic relation. Well, that in itself, on the one hand, is not an oppressive relation. It's just a division of labor without either the superstructurally ideas or in the interrelation of people. In actuality, it doesn't carry the weight of one being over the other. But you can see how there are seeds of how that natural division of labor could be turned into something else with the emergence of private property, with the change in the productive forces in such a way that the production relations begin to get a division of labor that becomes more antagonistic. Then that social relation, especially with the emergence of private property, an accumulation of surpluses that are done privately rather than being, generally speaking, the property of the group as a whole, then into that enters this whole beginning of antagonism around the relation between men and women, because then the men, being in more position to do so in many circumstances, will be the ones who begin to appropriate more of the property that's appropriated privately unto themselves. The women will still have this role, and there will be a tendency developing increasingly for them to be subordinated to the men and to become, then the men, when they get private property and they're more the ones who are accumulating it, become more concerned about who's going to what's going to be done with that property when they're done, so to speak. In other words, inheritance. And then they want to begin to pass on this property to their own descendants and not to anybody. Anybody's descendants. After all, I mean, once you've broken up the social accumulation, that's accompanied by superstructural expressions, including ideas about the importance of private appropriation. There's a change in the thinking of people in that way. So then the men who dominate in this process, because of the, you know, related to this natural division of labor, which before didn't have any bigger implications in terms of antagonistic relations or the expression of that in a superstructure, but now begins to, these men want to pass on this property. There's a whole thing that goes along with it, you know, in the superstructure, including in the thinking. They want to pass it to their descendants, so they want to know who the hell their descendants are. So they want to control the sexual activity of the women in a way that they hadn't done before and that society didn't feel was necessary or wanted to have done before. And so then you get the women being in this increasingly subordinated position. And then, you know, this develops through and takes different forms in different sets of production relations according to varying circumstances and changes, not, again, in some orderly procession, you know, beginning with early communal society, slavery, you know, and again, sort of a teleological view that it's all marching forward towards some great good end, namely communism, at the end of this whole process. But through a very complex process, this division of labor remains as long as you have, and this antagonism remains as long as you have private accumulation and private property, particularly private property in the means of production, in the means of creating more wealth and employing other people to create more wealth for you. And it's developed to a very high state, you know, a person slave, when you begin taking slaves, or, you know, in later forms or other forms, you know, feudalism and capitalism, the same thread remains. And at least it gets implemented in the laws that the children of the woman who is in essence your property, usually in the form of a wife, sometimes in the form of a concubine or whatever, that the child or the children of that woman are your children. Now, this allows for the practical reality that sometimes the women, you know, don't feel like making love to the man anymore. And they may, you know, they may, while the man will try to restrict and prevent them from doing anything else and punish them severely and the whole society will join in, it still happens. But this takes care of that problem from the angle of property, because more or less the children that are brought forth by this woman are assumed to be the children of her husband for the purposes of property relations and inheritance and so on, unless it can be shown that it's, that it, you know, and often the husband doesn't even want it to be shown, but if for whatever reasons it comes out, then you have a whole, then you have the whole phenomenon, you read Shakespeare or whatever about the bastard, you know, and what role do they get to play in relation to the inheritance of property? And often they get shoved out of the picture. Because if you start having all these bastards inheriting, and I'm using the term literally here, it has nothing to do with their personality. You know, it's the phenomenon of not being legitimately born in an accepted wedlock, quote unquote. But, you know, in Shakespeare, it's the bastard, this and that. You know, do they have a right to inherit the throne? And often they're pushed out and then they'll kill the legitimate son and usurp the throne. There's a lot of this stuff that you see going on in literature, right? Well, we are kind of ranging here, but anyway, the point is, you know, this is a way of controlling the inheritance of property. You know, and this is a social relation, but bound up with, and the relation between women and men that's all completely, you know, interwoven with this is a social relation, but it's obviously closely integrated with the essential production relations. And all of this stuff gets reflected in the superstructure. I mean, all the ideas that the role of a woman is to bear children, that a woman should be faithful to a man, but then everybody knows boys will be boys. Because if they boys are boys and they go out and, you know, and they're not completely faithful, we have a legal means of dealing with that problem, quote-unquote, we, the male-dominated society, which is, you know, unless it comes out that they're a bastard and there's a whole crisis, quote unquote, then they, you know, the children that get produced by men running around with other people's wives, whatever, are assumed to be the children of the woman whose property, you know, the man whose property the woman is. So that's where the superstructure comes in the form not only of ideas but of laws, inheritance laws, and so on. And that's why you sometimes get battles, however, where one, you know, one son who wants to, and usually the, you know, preponderance goes to the males in terms of inheritance, because now you have a whole male supremacist society. Then you get battles between, you know, the legitimate son and the bastard son, or, you know, or the second son who gets less inheritance tries to prove that the first son is a bastard so he can get the throne or whatever, even petty property there. This is what all this gives rise to. But these are all social relations, which in turn are interwoven, however, with the essential, you know, economic production relations. And all of this has its expression in the superstructure, not just in ideas, but in laws, you know, in inheritance laws, as well as, you know, other forms in the superstructure of customs and social, even things like social pressure to get, you know, like, or in social conditioning. There's the infamous role of the mother-in-law in all these kind of things. You know, the mother-in-law is what? Speaking specifically for the woman in the relationship, the mother-in-law is the mother of the head of the household. And the head of the household has to go out in the world and do whatever he's doing. So the mother-in-law is there to police the wife. You know, if anybody ever watches Desperate Housewives, there was a whole thing there with, you know, the Solis couple. You know, and you know, it's a rather crude expression of commodity relations. She's a former model, and you know, it's a valuable trinket for him to have her as a wife. You know, and she expects, you know, she wants to be able to go shopping, you know, for lots of things, and wants a life that she came out of poverty, and she doesn't want to live in poverty. She wants to live a lifestyle where she can have lots of things. So this is the arrangement they have. But then he goes off and does his work, and she gets bored and has an affair with the gardener, the teenage gardener. You know, so you got all these things. And at one point, you know, Mr. Solis begins to feel that his wife is just out of control, and he starts hearing rumors about her having an affair. What does he do? He brings in his mother, you know, to sit on the wife and keep her in line. And then there's all this tension between the wife and the mother-in-law. You know, the mother-in-law ends up dead, but that's another story. But without, you know, the point is, these are institutionalized things that are all part of enforcing this patriarchy, which has grown up together with and has become an integral part of the private appropriation, especially of means of production, but of property more generally. So these are social relations that are bound together with the essential production relations, and this all gets reflected in laws, customs, ideology, in the superstructure. And what was the other question? I forget.
How do you see the application of solid core and elasticity within the transformation of the production relations and in the economic base of society under socialism?
Okay, well, before I do that, you can see from what I was speaking to in the response to the previous question is why we need a future leap for humanity. You know, why it's not enough, you know, why there is some aspect of this technology and these productive forces that can be the foundation for a leap in, you know, in terms of being part of emancipation to a whole nother level. You know, we don't want to go back to the, you know, the early communal societies. We're not going to get into a sort of quasi-religious metaphysical argument about, you know, which, you know, would have been better if class society had ever developed or not. It did. You know, and without being, once again, teleological about it, it's all working out to a great end. The point is we are on the threshold, and part of the threshold, and an important part of the material foundation for that is that you do have a certain level of productive forces, including technology as well as knowledge among people, to be able to actually achieve communism and not have these even potentially antagonistic social relations become actually antagonistic, and then the reemergence of classes. One of the interesting things in that connection is that there was this article, I forget if it was in the New York Times or whatever, a number of years ago, about these people who decided to, for an experiment, live off the grid. So they went somewhere, I forget where, Idaho or something, and they detached themselves from all the, no internet, not all the modern technology. And one of the things that was very striking was, in this article, was that pretty quickly, this was a family, the traditional role for this woman who in the family, who was a professional woman and was still within the confines of capitalism, but to a large degree, you know, to the large degree with which it's possible within those confines, had broken out of the traditional role and was significantly forced back into it, because there were certain household chores, including even things like chopping of wood, that the division of spontaneous division of labor that developed, the husband had to go out and do other things, and it made more sense according to division of labor for him to do those, and the woman ended up with all these, you know, onerous, heavy-weighing household tasks, and some of the more traditional antagonism between men and women began to assert itself in some, as I say, in sort of more traditional forms. So while it's not the theory of the productive forces, we've seen, you know, from many different angles why that's wrong. The more technology you have, the more advanced social relations you have. It's not as if there is no role for technology and for generally the development of the productive forces, including especially people and their conscious dynamic role with their knowledge and skills and so on. But it's not as if that's somehow unimportant in being able to leap to communism and not have the reemergence of class relations. So anyway, your other question about the solid core and elasticity and the transformation of the production relation. Well, once again, if we're assuming we're talking here about socialist society, you know, there, I spoke about how there are three, how Lenin identified three different aspects of the production relations, the most important being the ownership system. And then, very importantly, the overall division of labor of society and the according relation of different groups in the distribution of the social wealth. And Mao, during the experience of the Chinese Revolution and building socialism in China, in studying a Soviet economic textbook, which, you know, was written when the Soviet Union was, in fact, you know, was in the process of restoring capitalism and a bourgeoisie was actually in power, but which was putting it, this textbook forward as a textbook of socialism. Mao read and criticized this textbook, and his notes on that are published as a separate book and also can be found in various miscellany collections of Mao's writings and talks. And one of the things he pointed out there was that the Soviets were putting forward a very determinist view toward the transformation of the productive relations, that basically they were just seeing it as, like, you know, tied in with the theory of the productive forces. You have a certain ownership system, you develop more technology, you can get a, you know, more highly socialized form of ownership, you develop more technology and more, you know, higher again form of social ownership and so on. And Mao said this is very determinist and undialectical. He said at any given time, the underlying character of the productive forces and how developed the things are in that realm, including technologically, will set a certain objective stage, and that in particular will be reflected in terms of what the limits are of the ownership system you can have. Now, this posed itself very acutely in the countryside in China, where they were going from a feudal system, essentially, where you had a lot of very land-poor and landless peasants. And the first thing they did during the course of the first stage of the revolution, which was, from an historical standpoint, and even in terms of its economic tasks as well as its political task, was more or less a bourgeois democratic revolution. Up till 1949, in carrying out the People's War and winning more and more of the territory in the countryside, they were basically carrying out a bourgeois democratic revolution, as Mao said, but of a new type. That's why he called it new democracy, because it was led by the proletariat, not the bourgeoisie, and laid the groundwork. Yes, capitalism could follow, but it laid a more of a groundwork to make the leap to socialism. So for those reasons, the proletarian leadership and the potential of socialism, it was a new type of bourgeois democratic revolution, leading part of a different era of revolution, if you will, at least in potentiality. It could potentially be that. But what they were doing economically in the first stage was, you know, the central thing was giving land to the landless and land poor. You know, land to the tiller. They were implementing that slogan. Small, they were distributing the land of the landlords and some of the land, not most of the well-to-do peasants, to the poor peasants in the countryside who made up the great majority of the population who had either no or very little land or very poor land. So that was like the first big step they took, but that doesn't really get you at all beyond the realm of bourgeois right. In fact, that is an implementation of bourgeois right. Land to the tiller, private ownership of land. It's, you know, it's well within the system of commodity production and exchange, but it's a leap beyond the basically feudal forms of exploitation and the landless or land-poor condition of the peasants as a result. So then they went to the next step. They began to develop forms of very early forms of cooperation of labor among the peasants, rather than even collectivizing ownership of the land on even a small scale. They first did cooperation of labor and then started pooling some implements of production, tools and things like that, as a way to build up toward first a lower and then a more advanced form of actual collective or social ownership of the land. Now here you see their interconnection between material factors and superstructural factors, or in particular ideological factors, because they're actually waging a class struggle in the countryside over whether the land is going to remain in, you know, privately owned. And therefore, if it does, it's going to go back to polarization between wealthy, large landowning segment of the population, a small segment, and large numbers exploited by them, again, with little or no of their own land. So this class struggle is taking place both in the ideological realm and in the practical realm, if you will. In other words, and there's an interconnection. I mean, you don't want to just appeal to the narrowest outlook of the peasants, but hey, you know, if you can't show in practice that it's a better way out for the peasants in terms of being able to overcome starvation and disease and all these other things, to collectivize things, then they're going to be drawn toward forces who are going to argue to do it otherwise, and even if it means going back to what they had before. So they actually had to, you know, win this battle to show that this was a better way to do it, by collectivizing first labor and tools and things like that. And it was a real struggle. A lot of the peasants who had a little bit of something folded their arms and sat back and said, well, I'll do my own private farming and let's see how this collective thing works out. Well, you don't just passively accept that. You wage ideological struggle. If you look at a lot of the culture that came out during the Cultural Revolution, it's reflecting even the struggles they had in this early period. But you also have to make these transformations and show in practice, if you will, in a very real sense, that by the peasants pooling their labor and then their implements and then eventually beginning to pool land, they have a much better way out than working all on their own. And you know, you compare and contrast what's happening in the two by the two different means. The polarization that sets in, the reassertion of exploitation and poverty, and pretty soon you combine that with in combination with the ideological struggle and with changes going on in the society in a larger sense, so that you begin, so that the collectivization of agriculture fits into a larger transformation of the economy, you can win out in this struggle and draw more and more peasants to that. And then you still face the question of how to make leaps going from one stage to another. And that was what Mao was saying, was the Soviets are very determinist about this. Only, and very one-sided, only through more technology could you have, you know, leaps in the social and level of social ownership. Whereas Mao said, well, you know, the general state of the economy, not just in agriculture, but overall, and including, importantly, what your level of technology is, will generally determine how high a level of collective ownership you can have. Because if you try to have ownership on a very big scale, but the peasants have to put a tremendous amount of labor just into getting anything out of the land, so to speak, then that means will be proven in practice to be inefficient. It won't work, it'll break down. You won't be able to produce enough to advance the standard of living of the peasants. And so, you know, you have to go for a lower level of ownership where the peasants can work together. They don't have, you know, for example, look at the South in the U.S. after World War II. You had, up to that time, you had, you know, in the South, mainly tilling of the land was not done by tractors. It was done by, you know, horses or mules or whatever, and even handheld plows. And then, you know, this was not a socialist revolution, but there was a big change as a result of World War II. It unleashed a lot of stuff, and they began, the majority of farms in the South within a, more or less a decade after World War II went from being not having tractors to having tractors. Well, when you have a tractor, you can till a lot more land in a lot shorter time. It's a mechanized way, you know, it can do a lot more work than a person. So it doesn't make sense anymore to have, let's say, 40 people working on a particular parcel of land, tilling it, and especially when you get mechanical pickers, that replaces the hand picking of the crops. So you begin to get a different social organization. You expel a lot of the people doing the hand labor and use machines in place of a lot of those people. And then, you know, if you go back to the socialist system, if you're trying to implement the same kind of thing but in a socialized way, then there isn't, you can see there's an interconnection by looking at that example of the South between the need for the development of further, you know, further introduction, development and introduction of more technology to be able to support the use of the land as a unit of production on a larger scale. And then if you do that, then the peasants can be released to do other things. Either their hours of labor altogether can be reduced, and or they can be freed up, for example, to work on public work projects. You know, you can free up more people to do that. So you can see there's an and then, you know, that changes again the production relations, and it changes the outlook of the people, because instead of tilling a small piece of land individually or working with 10 other people on a small piece of land, which is all you can do efficiently in the absence of this technology, all of a sudden you can work a lot more land with people working together and free up a lot more labor to go build a lot of cooperative projects, roads, dams, electro power plants, small, you can develop small industry in the countryside that wasn't there before. You get more agricultural produce per unit of input, so to speak, including hour of labor, so you can sell to the state the agriculture and you get more in return because you produce more agricultural produce, and they're still selling to the state. There's still commodity relations, even though you're working to overcome that. So then this, you know, gets going in a positive cycle, so to speak, where you have more basis for accumulating, you can get more technology, you can expand the area of land that you're cultivating with this technology, and you can make further transformations both in the production relations and in the thinking of the people. But Mao said, you know, all that's sort of essential. At any given time, within the limits of what the productive forces will allow your level of ownership to be, you can take a lot of initiative to change things through ideological and political struggle. So, for example, you can find ways, even within the general limit, to do things collectively that free women up from the household. And that does two things. It's important socially. It's important, well, you know, it's important in the whole dimension of both social relations and the superstructure. It's also important in relation to the production relations and, yes, to the development of production. Because women can be freed from being burdened with household work, that's a lot more people that can go out and join in working, you know, on the larger tasks of developing the economy. And as they go out into the larger world, not on its own and automatically, but this strengthens the material basis for A, their own outlook to be broadened out, to have a broader experience, and B, to wage the struggle in the society as a whole, including with men, about what is the quote-unquote proper role of women and why is it not what it's traditionally been. So there's that kind of, so Mao was saying you can seize a lot of initiative even before you can make a qualitative leap in the system of ownership. Now, what does solid core elasticity have to do with that? I don't know. No. I mean, I think the point is what it has to do with it is this is a basic approach to, you know, to understanding the world and to changing it, you know, and epistemologically you're going to see this applied in the sense of you have certain basic ideas about what you're setting out to do. But when you get into the richness and complexity and the contradictoriness of what you, of all these kind of processes that I'm talking about, and if you amplify that through a whole society and think about all the different elements of the economy that have to interact with that in a positive way, and then all the politics and all the culture that's involved in the battles that go on there about whether you should go this direction or that direction, and then you think about the international dimension and the whole threat of imperialism and how that distorts your economy so that you have to divert more than you would like to the production of weapons and the training of an army and the economic support of an army, which does not. See, that's the thing about an army. A professional army, while it may secondarily engage in production to help the people, is primarily not engaging in production and is living off. It is living off the population which is doing production. Now, what's the difference between, there some people say, well, there's no difference. Armies are armies. They're always bad. They always oppress the people. They live off the people. They stand above the people. End of discussion. No, this is a very real contradiction. And whether or not you can handle that contradiction correctly so that your army remains essentially not only drawn from the ranks of the people, but remains linked with the people, and so an antagonism doesn't develop between the people and the army, so that the army actually does not become an armed body standing over and oppressing the people, but actually becomes in its principal aspect, remember principal and secondary are fighting it out here, but in its principal aspect, the army is an expression, if you want to put it that way, of the will of the people, of a desire of the people to continue making revolution and to defend that revolution, and specifically to defend however that those goals are embodied in the Constitution and laws at a given time. So that's the difference between a proletarian army and a bourgeois army or the army of any other exploiting class. It is an expression of very different production and social relations, but production and social relations that are in transition from one thing to another and are locked themselves in acute contradiction. That's why there's still a potential for that army to become something that becomes the expression, if you want to put it this way, not of the will of the people, but of the will of new exploiters who control that army, taking advantage of the remaining division of labor in society, including between the city and the countryside, but especially between physical and mental labor, to themselves dominate that army and reproduce and raise to an antagonistic, exploitive basis those remaining reflections of the old production and social relations. That's what you're battling out, and this is all in the context of international imperialism. So there you go again, you're right to the brink many times of being drawn and quartered. But the solid core and elasticity is you have basic ideas about how all this is going to go, but in reality there's going to be a great deal of complexity that's going to come into the picture beyond what you can anticipate and calculate at a given time. And you have to be, plus in order to do all this, that's one dimension epistemologically, you have to be, not have everything, like have such a, use that word, even though it's a misleading word, a bureaucratic approach, or can be misleading, it's not necessarily misleading, have such a bureaucratic approach to planning and everything that there's no space for change, that there's no ability to adjust to reality, and no ability to listen to the ideas and criticisms of others as these things are first formulated and then unfold. And practically, in the political realm, in the realm of carrying out the practical struggle to transform society in all these spheres, you're going to have the same question of solid core and elasticity in the sense that we've been talking about it through here. You're going to have to unleash this whole process, which is full of contradiction to begin with, but you're actually, see, here's the drawn and quarter point, you're actually deliberately giving fuller expression to this contradictoriness in a certain way in order to get these things out into the open and in order to get the richest process going on and the deepest and fullest ferment so that you can continue resynthesizing as you go along. So that kind of outlook and methodology is going to be there both in terms of how you understand and continue to deepen and, yes, correct your understanding of what you're doing, and also the actual process of, if you will, mobilizing forces and then polarizing and repolarizing as the turmoil gets, generated and as all this ferment presents new challenges. Get ready for it, folks. Will be repeatedly happening over and over again. No, it won't be always on the same intense level. Yes, you will be able to Well, hopefully you won't want to step to the side and have a smoke. Hopefully you will have overcome that by then. But you'll be able to step to the side and take a deep breath and relax and recreate and whatever, you know, and do other things that are not, you know, just intensely carrying on the class struggle. But repeatedly, that's what's going to come to the fore. So I think that's the way in which this figures into this larger process. But, you know, you can see that this is why it takes work, and this is why it takes a certain orientation, and this is why you get the joy out of this by understanding what you're actually dealing with. And where, you know, where it's going, but also, you know, not only where it's going in the longest term sense, but actually what you're doing. As opposed to some idealist notion of what you ought to be able to do, which leads you to be totally frustrated all the time because things don't go that way. But what you are actually dealing with, what's the necessity that's going to continually repose itself to you, and then, you know, you do get the exhilaration of resolving those contradictions. And then you get to take a night off before you have to confront all the new contradiction that got brought into being by resolving the old ones.